we're at the very beginning stages of a very brutal and bloody conflict, of which if the people in this room and the people in the church do not bind together and really form what I feel is an aspect of the church militant to really be able to not just stand with our beliefs, but to fight for our beliefs against this new barbarity that's starting, that we will literally eradicate everything that we've been bequeathed over the last 2,500 years.
White House Chief Strategist Steve Bannon speaking via Skype to a conservative Catholic group a few years ago. His thoughts on religion, global politics, and the economy are not exactly mainstream. But since Donald Trump took over the White House, Bannon, the former head of Breitbart News, has been in the room when most major decisions have been made. And he's been credited as one of the main architects of many of Donald Trump's policies. He helped write Trump's inauguration speech, and he pushed the controversial travel ban. Joining us now to talk about Bannon and how his worldview is shaping the Trump administration is Time Magazine's editor-at-large, David Vondrelli. He profiled Bannon for a cover story that is out today. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, Bannon is a notoriously behind-the-scenes guy. He doesn't give a lot of interviews or speeches. Tell us a bit more about who he is and how he became the person he is today.
He's an extremely unusual, sort of only in America character. He's from Virginia, born and raised in a middle-class Democratic family. He went into the Navy after he graduated from college and served 7 years as an officer, distinguished career. But when he left, he got interested in business, got a Harvard MBA, went to work for Goldman Sachs, and then set up his own shop. But then along came 2008, and the economy collapsed, and one of the people who suffered was his working class father, who, you know, had his nest egg vanish. And Bannon, having come from the investment banking business, really blamed the bankers for that collapse, their high-flying risk-taking. So all of a sudden, here came this sort of Bernie Sanders streak into his politics, and he became really one of a kind as a thinker. And he's come under the influence of a theory that says that about every 80 years in American history comes a terrible crisis, always in the form of a war, that destroys the existing institutions and sets up new ones. And he believes that the time is now, and I think he sees the Trump administration as the opportunity to take command of that crisis and remake the world.
And increasingly, or at least in this speech that I played a clip from that he gave a few years ago, he is pitting the West against the East, and by the East, I mean Islam, that he thinks that there is going to be we're in the midst of a global battle between the Judeo-Christian West and Islam, correct?
That is correct. He feels that both the Bush administration and certainly the Obama administration failed to understand the scope of what he calls a global existential threat to our way of life from radical Islam. And that clip you played was a good example of it, but there's it really informs the way the website Breitbart.com and Bannon's old radio show that used to be hosted at Breitbart and on satellite radio, the way they viewed the world.
Well, let's play a clip of him from that radio show.
Islam is a religion of peace. Islam is not a religion of peace. Islam is
really
a religion
is
of submission. Islam means submission. I mean, the whole thing is just categorical.
He is
the epitome. Yeah. He's the Republican version, not a conservative. He's a Republican establishment country club version of the Clintons.
And there he's talking about President George W. Bush criticizing him for calling Islam a religion of peace. So as you reported, Bannon was pretty much the mastermind behind the refugee ban that Donald Trump signed last week. And he even overrode advice from the Department of Homeland Security. How much power does he now have in the White House?
Well, that's a moving question and a moving target. In the wake of the of the fiasco with the refugee ban, the president is said to be very upset about the way it was done, the way it was communicated, and he is said to have sort of put Bannon back in his box and restored or underlined the fact that Reince Priebus is the chief of staff. But, you know, Donald Trump is famous for enjoying conflict among his employees. He likes to have competing centers of ideas. He thinks that produces, you know, more creative thinking if people are trying to elbow each other aside. And he also has, we've seen throughout his campaign, two very different sort of personas. One is, you know, the can-do chief executive who just wants to get good deals done. And the other is this image of himself as the leader of some really important historical movement. And that second, you know, persona is the one that Bannon appeals to and speaks to. And I think as long as Bannon continues to be in the White House and have walk-in privileges in the Oval Office and this close relationship with the president, he'll continue to have very significant influence.
And he does now have a seat on the National Security Council's Principals Committee.
Yes, that was a shock to the sort of national security foreign policy community of the United States, active and retired. Now, it should be said, I'll remind your listeners, he does have military experience. He has a master's from Georgetown in national security studies. So it's not outlandish, but as I think people can tell from the clips you've played, he certainly does not have traditional security views or foreign policy views.
What about his views on nationalism and white nationalism? Breitbart has been called a white nationalist news outlet. What are Bannon's views on that, on race?
He strongly rejects the idea that he is a racist, and I didn't find any writings or radio clips to suggest otherwise, but there's no question that the website, Breitbart.com, of which he was for many years executive chairman, no question that they play very, very, you know, way out there in terms of being provocative on race issues.
And as you said, that he was very much affected by the economic collapse, especially personally, and how it affected his father back in 2008. And he has criticized overweening, unbridled capitalism and crony capitalism, for that matter. What is his remedy when it comes to helping people who are negatively affected by globalization?
You know, that's a great question, and he's a lot less specific about that. He believes, as does the president, that a more nationalist trade policy will be good for the economy. So I think he would say that they're going to bring more jobs back to the United States, that they're going to force our trading partners to buy more of our exports, and that that will help people who need a raise or need a job in the United States. And it seems clear from the first 2 weeks that the Trump administration is going to go in that direction and is moving there already. And so we'll have a chance to see whether, in fact, that has positive economic impacts.
And when he says we're at war with Islam and radical Islam, does he literally mean that we need to go to war with places like Iran or step up our bombing campaign in Syria?
We'll see. I mean, I hate to say that in that way. He has said on his radio show, and we need to remember that, popular talk radio is deliberately provocative, and so things get said that might not get said in a Oval Office meeting, we hope. But he has used the phrase, we're headed toward another shooting war in the Middle East. He's said the same thing about possible war with China over shipping lanes in the South China Sea. This, is part of the reason that we devoted as much space and attention as we did to Mr. Bannon this week, is because the public, has a right to know and hopefully get more answers from him about whether he meant those things literally or figuratively.
Time Magazine's editor-at-large, David Vondrelli. His profile of Stephen Bannon is out today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Trump supporter and Breitbart news writer Milo Yiannopoulos was scheduled to talk at UC Berkeley yesterday, but violent protests broke out, and so the event was canceled for public safety reasons. Faculty members said Yiannopoulos violated Berkeley's code of conduct. They called his frequent talking points, quote, harassment, slander, defamation, and hate speech. But hate speech is not illegal, something that Milo Yiannopoulos often cites when controversy arises. David Snyder is executive director of the nonprofit The First Amendment Coalition. He's also an attorney based in the Bay Area, and he specializes in the First Amendment. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, Yiannopoulos, he portrays himself as a champion of free speech. I just want to play a clip of him on CNBC last fall talking about the importance of free speech.
The First and Second Amendment, freedom of speech, free expression, the right to be, do, and say whatever you want. These are the values that have made America the greatest country in the history of human civilization. These are values that are not compatible with some of the Islamic immigration that we see in Europe.
Okay, so, and he's also made much hay over the cancellation of his speech yesterday, saying it's ironic that at Berkeley, the birthplace of the free speech movement, his speech was canceled. What is your reaction?
Well, the First Amendment's protections for speech are very broad, and there are narrow exceptions, and those narrow exceptions tend to not be applicable before speech is made. In other words, the government is extremely limited in how it can limit speech before speech occurs. And so while many people find the things that Yiannopoulos says offensive and harmful and hurtful, as a general matter, those types of comments, the type of speech that he engages in, which I think could fairly be characterized as hate speech, they're protected under the First Amendment. And the government is not allowed under the First Amendment to bar speech like that before it happens. And it's also limited to the degree to which it can punish such speech after it occurs.
And that is certainly the reason the chancellor gave for letting him give the speech in the first place. He said he could not exercise prior restraint on what he was going to say. But yet 100-plus faculty members objected. They said that his speech amounted to incitement, harassment, defamation, and they pointed to a speech he gave recently at the University of Milwaukee, where he actually projected a picture of a trans student he was criticizing during his speech as an example of harassment. And so where can officials draw the line between free speech and some form of incitement to violence?
Well, first, I think that the chancellor's absolutely correct in that the university is limited in how thoroughly or if at all it can prevent the speech before it happens. As I said, the protections are very broad, especially beforehand. That said, speech can be punished. The First Amendment is not limitless. You can't say anything you want at any time under any circumstances. Speech that incites violence, and that's actually a very specific type of incitement, which I'll talk about in just a second. But speech that incites violence is not protected under the First Amendment. But in order to be speech that incites violence, it has to be a specific threat at a specific person. That is generally not what you see at broad public demonstrations or speeches that are made to large audiences. So if a speaker calls for revolution or he says people should take up arms and take to the streets, that kind of a comment is not generally considered under the First Amendment to be incitement to violence. It's also the classic example of yelling fire in a crowded theater,
mm-hmm.
Saying something that's going to cause people to riot, that has an extreme likelihood of causing people to riot, may be punishable under the First Amendment. But it's really important to understand that you can't, that a government agency, and I think UC Berkeley falls under this category because it's taxpayer funded, can't prohibit speech before it happens based on the possibility that those things might occur. It's the university's obligation to ensure the safety of both the speaker and the protest and any protesters who are there, as well as the audience. And they're not permitted under the First Amendment to bar the speech before it happens because of what might happen. Now, whether Yiannopoulos or anybody else speaking can be punished after the fact is a separate question, and punishment after the fact is extremely limited as well. So what government can do in terms of quelling or quashing speech is very limited.
But let's say you have a speaker who has a history of giving speeches that result in violence or an incitement to violence. Doesn't the university have a responsibility to protect its students from said violence?
Absolutely. The university has an obligation to protect the safety of its students, and they should do that. And I don't think the First Amendment envisions that government agencies should completely stand down where there's a real threat of violence. But whether the university bolsters its security force or whether it creates barriers to prevent protesters from smashing windows and so forth is a completely separate question from whether the university can prohibit the speech from happening at all. So the university's obligation to protect students is absolutely there. But the university doesn't have an obligation, and indeed doesn't have the right, to protect students from speech they don't want to hear. So speech that students find uncomfortable or threatening in a rhetorical way, not physically threatening, but threatening, those types of fears don't provide any basis for the government to prevent the speech from going forward.
David Snyder, Executive Director of the First Amendment Coalition, thank you.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think Milo Yiannopoulos should have been given the opportunity to give his speech at UC Berkeley yesterday or not? Do you think that he is too radioactive and incites violence and should not be allowed to speak on campus? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up next, we'll hear from the former U.S. ambassador to Germany, John Emerson, about what he thinks Europe is thinking about President Trump and the new administration, especially regarding the new policy in refugees. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. World leaders have criticized Donald Trump for his travel ban against seven countries in the Middle East and Africa. Last night, the president reportedly had a heated exchange with Australia's prime minister over refugees. France's foreign minister called accepting refugees a duty. And German Chancellor Angela Merkel said the ban was against the core idea of international aid for refugees and international cooperation. But with Britain leaving the European Union and far-right politicians gaining support, Angela Merkel and other moderates in Europe find themselves increasingly isolated. With a new administration taking control in the United States, ambassadors to most European countries are being replaced. The outgoing American ambassador to Germany is John Emerson. He's now back at home here in Los Angeles. So we invited him into the studio. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back.
I guess outgoing, you're gone.
I'm gone. I'm now
officially gone.
Ambassador RET, which means retired.
So you had to leave on Inauguration Day?
That was yeah, it? I was somewhere over Greenland when he raised his right hand to take the oath of office. Typically what happens is you do expect to leave when a new administration comes in, particularly if you're a political appointee, as I was. But what they often say is, submit a letter of resignation effective January 20th, but you have till March 1st. And if there are special circumstances, we'd be happy to consider that. And this was somewhat unusual in that not only the ambassadors, but senior members of the State Department who were political appointees, who are career Foreign Service officials, were also asked to leave.
And is that unusual?
That's unusual.
So is there anyone there who has replaced you and your top
deputies? No. Well, what happens is every ambassador has a deputy chief of mission. I call it a chief operating officer to a chief executive officer sort of relationship. And that person, even when a current ambassador leaves the country, the DCM becomes the chargé d'affaires. Mm-hmm. So right now, Kent Loxton, who was my DCM, is the chargé, and he will probably be in that role until July or August. I mean, even if they move quickly to identify a new ambassador to Germany, it takes a long time to go through the background check to get confirmed by the Senate. The final words Angela Merkel said to me were, "I cannot believe you have to leave so soon. I'm really, really sorry to see you go."
Oh. What is the biggest worry in Germany and in larger Europe when it comes to this incoming administration?
Well, it's interesting. The thing that I got the most attention for when I arrived was about 8 weeks after I got there, the news broke about the Merkel cell phone being tapped. So that was sort of my introduction to Germany. But what was interesting about it was literally the first series of questions that I got from journalists, from business people, and from folks at senior levels of the government was concern about pivot to Asia. Mm-hmm. And the reason there was that concern is there is a deep understanding in Europe of the importance not only of the European project, you know, moving after the Second World War to a Europe whole, free, and at peace, but also the importance of the United States being engaged and maintaining an engagement in that effort. And so with the comment about pivot to Asia, there was real concern, oh my goodness, is the United States going to withdraw from Europe, withdraw from the Mideast, withdraw from the world? And I would just imagine that that concern is now on steroids with the incoming administration, not only on the basis of some of the rhetoric of the campaign, which was clearly a departure from what had been a long-held bipartisan consensus that Americans' national security interest is in part built on a foundation of strong ties to Europe and a strong commitment to NATO. So there was nervousness about a departure from that consensus. And I'm afraid the last 10 days has done nothing to reassure our allies on that score.
Although President Trump has said that TPP is dead, Trans-Pacific Partnership is dead, Steve Bannon has said that it was a mistake to pivot to Asia and that he wanted to renew ties to Europe. He thinks that there's a special relationship between the United States and Europe, especially with Britain. So is that not reassuring to European leaders?
At this point, they're going to be paying attention less to the words and more to the behavior, you know, not so much watch what I say, but what I do. Candidly, this is what I was advising them. I mean, they were getting all spun up about these different tweets going on during the transition. I said, don't pay attention to the tweets. This is how Donald Trump is going to continue to communicate with his base. It's part of what got him here, and he's going to continue doing that. And there's a long, big distance between 140 characters and a policy that comes out of the U.S. government policymaking machine, and that's what you ought to be paying attention to. So obviously, if Bannon made that comment, I haven't read that or heard that. That I think on a certain measure would be reassuring. But then the question is, what do they do about it? But fundamentally, Europeans, particularly Germans, are concerned about values and American values. And they see values reflected in issues like how you address human rights, the refugee situation, as an example, climate change. What I did say to not only the chancellor, but also her senior advisors was, I thought it would be a good idea for her to get over here and meet with President Trump as quickly as possible. I think for the two of them to begin to establish a personal relationship would be very, very important.
What about Russia and Donald Trump's relationship with Vladimir Putin? In his conversation with Vladimir Putin, he did not bring up sanctions. He has said it is too early to revisit this idea of sanctions, but it is possible that he might drop the sanctions against Russia. How would that go over in Germany and in Europe?
Well, it's interesting. Germany is a little schizophrenic on this topic. By and large, the policy of the government and certainly the policy of the chancellor and her party is reflected in the sanctions regimen and is reflected in the concept that in the 21st century, we cannot allow powerful nations to unilaterally redraw the border lines of other smaller, weaker countries, and that this concept of a zone of influence or a sphere of influence where you can do whatever you want is unacceptable. And so I think there's a big part of German in the foreign policy community that would be very, very concerned about that, and in the military community, candidly, the NATO and folks and all that. On the other hand, there is a significant percentage of the German population that grew up in the former East, and they learned Russian as their second language, not English.
Certainly Angela Merkel did.
Yeah, well, exactly. Now, some people like Angela Merkel sort of know what happens with a totalitarian regime, and they do not want to head in that direction, and they know they need to set boundary lines and stick to them. And then there's some people in the business community, I call them the Greater Switzerland crowd, and their attitude is, well, why aren't we in the middle of, you know, the United States and Russia? Maybe a bipolar world is better than this monopolar world we seem to be in, and it's good for business. And I think, by and large, the idea of having Russia integrated into the world economy, into the Western economy, is fantastic. But you can't do that and at the same time fail to sanction bad behavior and massive violations of human rights and coddle up to someone who regularly jails or chases out of the country NGOs, political opponents, journalists. I mean, those are our values.
Has anyone in the new administration contacted you or talked to you about what your opinions are and to get any advice moving forward?
No. And I've offered that. I have also offered, and candidly, once my successor is identified, I will make an effort to sit down with that person because it's in all of our interests that they be successful. And they're going to have a tough job. I had a tough job walking into the whole NSA scandal and all that. And they're going to have a tough job walking into, I think, a high degree of skepticism about the new administration. And I'd be more than happy to sit down with them and try to give them the kind of advice that my predecessor was able to give me, which I found very, very helpful about, you know, who are the right people to establish relationships with? What are some of the concerns? The existence of anti-American feelings in Germany, which there is often at a grassroots level. And also, you know, hey, Mission Germany's got 2,000 people in it. We have 35,000 troops, American troops that are based in Germany. I mean, there's a whole lot that I would be happy to share with my successor about just how you manage that. So, you know, he or she doesn't, you know, walk in and inadvertently trip on themselves. I've also been on the other side. I mean, I was day one in the Clinton White House when Bill Clinton came in. And I mean, you're overwhelmed. You are really drinking from a fire hose. And it takes a month or two to sort of get your sea legs. And obviously, every new president, and this one has clearly followed this, wants to hit the ground running, wants to send a message to their supporters that they're moving forward on the promises of the campaign. And by the way, to that, I would just say everybody needs to be aware that elections have consequences. And hopefully one of the benefits of this one will is that in particular, a lot of young people will become even more activated than they were before. I know that's happening with my daughters on their college campuses.
Well, John Emerson, I want to thank you so much for coming in today. It's been a
real
pleasure.
Well, my pleasure. It's great to see you. It's great to be back home, particularly given this weather in February and what I left
in Berlin.
It's
nice not to be in Berlin, right. John Emerson is America's former ambassador to Germany. Coming up, Pulitzer Prize winning author Viet Thanh Nguyen is here to talk about his new collection of short stories, The Refugees. He was a refugee himself from Vietnam, and he says there's a big difference between refugees and immigrants.
Immigrants, if they depart legally, go through certain kinds of channels, but refugees end up oftentimes on the open seas or trekking through the wilderness and spending months or even years, even decades, in refugee camps where they're really barely kept alive.
Viet Thanh Nguyen, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing.
Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. With executive orders affecting immigrants and refugees, many people are thinking about how these communities have fit into American society. That's certainly been on the mind of Yet Tan Nguyen. He won a Pulitzer Prize last year for his novel, The Sympathizer, and now he has a new book of short stories called The Refugees. It comes out next week. The collection tells the stories of people living between two worlds, how they switch identities and navigate issues of love, family, and immigration. I spoke with Yet Tan Nguyen earlier this week about his book and what's happening now in America.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, so obviously your book is about refugees. It's called The Refugees. We're a refugee. You make the distinction I've read elsewhere between refugee and immigrant.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that somewhere in my mind, I'm still a refugee. It's hard to get over that. I think some people want to get over it. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I have gotten over a lot of what it means to be a refugee. But the importance of being a refugee stays with me. And the importance of it is that it's different from being an immigrant. And an immigrant is someone who voluntarily comes somewhere, who voluntarily leaves things behind. Refugees are forced to flee, and they've lost a lot. And they carry that sense of loss with them, that sense of being unwanted to wherever it is that they arrive.
But you don't think some immigrants feel the same way, that they would love to stay in their own country, but for perhaps economic reasons, maybe not for fear of losing your own life or whatever, that they have to emigrate? They'd rather stay put in their own countries?
Partially, it is a matter of where you are on the spectrum. I think it's certainly true that many immigrants don't necessarily want to leave, but nevertheless, they have the option. So immigrants, if they depart legally, go through certain kinds of channels. But refugees end up oftentimes on the open seas or trekking through the wilderness and spending months or even years, even decades in refugee camps where they're really barely kept alive. So these experiences are really traumatic, and I think they do help to define refugees differently than immigrants. And of course, how they are perceived is vastly different. Generally, there's this idea that we're a country of immigrants, but we're not a country of refugees. And refugees arrive with that stigma of being the unwanted.
Mm. Is that what you felt when you arrived? You were only 4 years old, so perhaps you didn't feel it at that moment.
For me, my memory as a human being begins with being a refugee. That, you know, I came to consciousness in a refugee camp in the United States, and my first real memories were being separated from my parents and being sent to live with a white sponsor family when I was 4 years old. So I did definitely feel unwanted and wasn't able to make sense out of that as a child. As an adult, I can look back and think and can see that Vietnamese refugees were in one sense wanted because the Congress and the president permitted us to come into the country, but the majority of Americans at the time did not want to accept Vietnamese and other Southeast Asian refugees from Cambodia and Laos. We were foreign, we were different, we were the enemy, even if we technically weren't the enemy. That tension between being allowed to come in but being aware that not everybody wanted us around was definitely present in my life.
So you must see parallels with what's happening now with the recent executive order banning immigrants and refugees from certain countries, at least for now. Definitely Syrian refugees are now not allowed into the country for the time being. You must see some parallels.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in one sense, it's a reversal, obviously, because the executive order is to prevent more people from coming in, whereas, you know, President Ford and the Congress, you know, passed special actions to let people come in. But the fear directed against Syrian refugees and other refugees from the Middle East, I definitely do see a parallel between what happened earlier. It's easy to look at our contemporary moment and provide various reasons why certain populations shouldn't be let in, obscuring the fact that most of these justifications are based on fear rather than on fact. You know, Syrians have not killed anybody in the United States.
Right. Yeah. Let's talk about one of your stories, which, if I'm interpreting it correctly, is based on some of your own memories as a child. And this is the story War Years. The narrator is a young boy. His parents are shopkeepers, and I believe your parents owned a grocery store or a shop in San Jose?
Yeah, this is the only autobiographical story I've ever written. We moved from Harrisburg to San Jose in 1978. My parents opened probably the second Vietnamese grocery store in this city. And so I grew up intimately aware with what it meant to live a hard scrabble life with my parents working 12 to 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, and every day of the year except Christmas, New Year's, and Easter, and getting shot in an armed robbery on Christmas Eve, as happened to them, and various other terrible things as well. And to me, that was partly what shaped my sense of being a refugee, that, you know, we had to struggle and survive and we were under great threat.
And one of the characters in this is a woman named Mrs. Waugh. And she comes to try to get your mother to donate to her cause, which is to support the resistance in Vietnam against the communist regime, to kind of refight the battle and try to win the Vietnam War after it's over. And your mother, or the mother in the story, doesn't have any extra money. And Mrs. Waugh is seen as, well, she's not entirely welcome until you actually find out what's driving her.
Yeah. And something partly is based on fact. My mother did tell me at one point that people in the community were being asked to donate money to this resistance against communists. And I certainly saw that happening as well. And there was a hint of extortion. You know, if you didn't donate, then people would call you a communist. So in the dynamics of the story, it's two women who are pitted against each other. Both of them are trying to survive. One has the money. One's trying to get the money. And they both have valid reasons for what they're doing, because as we eventually find out, this woman who's a blackmailer, the reason why she's doing these things is because she's traumatized that she's lost her husband and her son to the communists. And this is the only way that she knows how to cope. So yes, she's doing a terrible thing. But so many people in the community were doing terrible things at the time because they were so deeply affected by what had happened to them.
But what does that also say about the alienation that the refugees felt when they came to the United States, the alienation they felt amongst each other, that they were sort of, as you say, pitted against each other in your story?
You know, growing up in the Vietnamese community, what I was really aware of was that we were a wonderful group of people. And Vietnamese people are very hospitable. They'll welcome you into their house. If you're a friend or a relative, it's a bond until you die. The community that knew you so well also knew where your weaknesses and vulnerabilities were. And the way that that manifested itself in the everyday lives of Vietnamese refugees was through things like domestic violence, child abuse, alcoholism, and the phenomenon of home invasions. We coined this during the 1980s, that the Vietnamese young people were invading the homes of Vietnamese people to rob them because they knew where the money was. In my own household, my parents said, don't open the door to Vietnamese people. So one day, a man comes knocking on our door, and he's not Vietnamese. So someone in our house opens the door, and he's the one with the gun. And that makes its way into the story.
That really happened to
you? That really happened. The gun was right in my face. Yeah.
And then the mother in the story, I don't know if this actually happened in real life, but the mother in the story is the one who goes out and sort of chases him down.
That really did happen. The gun was in our face. The man said, get on your knees. And both my father and I did as ordered. But my mother was the one who just ran screaming past him out the door and saved our lives, basically. I don't know what would have happened if she hadn't done that. And then he turned around and my father shoved him out the door and slammed the door and locked it behind him, locking my mother out as well. But, you know, we lived two doors from the highway. And so there was always traffic on that street. So she ran out in that street. Everybody saw her. That guy had no choice but to run away at that point.
Was he ever caught?
No.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Viet Thanh Nguyen. His new collection of short stories is called The Refugees. It seems like a lot of the characters here are pretty lonely and on their own.
Yeah, and I think that's a marker of refugee life. I mean, you bond together as a community, so refugees like to live with other refugees, right? But they've also lost so many things, so many people. They've lost their identities, they've lost their relatives, and a lot of them are profoundly alone as they're trying to cope with being in a new country and trying to find a new life when everything has been taken away from them. And so even living within a family or a community, I think people were oftentimes troubled by their past and couldn't communicate about it and couldn't help each other.
And in terms of the communication, were you able to communicate with your parents about their experience and really understand where you came from and what they wanted in their new country?
I came when I was 4, and so my Vietnamese was sort of arrested at a young age. I had enough Vietnamese to be definitely aware of the kinds of stories that they were telling about what had happened to them in Vietnam and what turned us into refugees and the terrible things that they had experienced. And I certainly had enough Vietnamese to understand what the people in the community were saying. And through repetition, I absorbed those kinds of stories, which when you're a boy growing up in this country as an American, as I was also, these stories were alienating because they were so foreign from the American experience.
So what happens when you go back to Vietnam?
When I go back to Vietnam, it depends what people want from me. If they want money from me, I'm an American. I'm wealthy. If they want emotional connection with me, then I'm Vietnamese. So it's a very ambivalent kind of experience going back to Vietnam because they, you know, have these deeply held notions of essential Vietnamese identity. And yet at the same time, they're quite aware that the world has changed because of the war and because of globalization and that the Vietnamese overseas have been transformed in some way. So they are as conflicted about us as we are about them.
Let me talk about the last story in the book, because in that you've got a doubling theme of two families, really, one father, two sets of siblings. He names them the same names. And one set of siblings stays in Vietnam and the other set lives in the United States. And then one woman, an American woman, comes and visits her sister in Vietnam of the same name. And it's interesting to see the culture clash there. And I guess I'm wondering if you think about that a lot. Think about, well, what if I had been the one who stayed in Vietnam? What would my life be like? I mean, you must think about that all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And that story is actually based on someone's true story, not my own, but someone mentioned to me that that's what happened to her. Refugees are always preoccupied by the what could have been. And the people who we left behind, who have seen us leave and have fashioned these new other lives, I think they also think what could have been if I had gotten on that boat or that airplane, or if history had just taken a slightly different turn for me.
But in this case, the one who is left behind, so to speak, she has an unrealistic view of who her American sister is. And we find out that her life isn't as glamorous as she imagines. So I think on both sets, right, you're saying that both sets have these fantasies and misconceptions of the other side.
Yeah, absolutely. The ones who leave want to return oftentimes because they retain this idea, this fantastic idea of what the homeland was like. And I've known many Vietnamese people in the United States who've lived here for decades, and they go around saying, I'm 100% Vietnamese. And then they go back home, and then they come back and say, I'm a Vietnamese-American. Or in my father's case, he came back, and over Thanksgiving, he said, we're Americans now. Never heard this from him before. So they discover that the reality has changed back there. And the people back there, they hear these stories. They basically hear American propaganda and Vietnamese-American propaganda about how wonderful life is over there. And it's very commonplace that actually some of these Vietnamese-Americans who go back to Vietnam and pretend that they're so successful, I mean, the joke is they're actually busboys, for example. But, you know, with $1,000 in Vietnam, you could live fairly well, at least for a couple of weeks, and pretend that you're somebody that you're not. And I wanted to take that very basic story of sort of comic misperception that is unique not only to the Vietnamese, but to other immigrant groups as well, and see what would happen if it was actually the case that the real identity of this overseas Vietnamese is revealed to her idyllic, her sister who worships her basically, and then has to confront what happens when that illusion is stripped away.
And is that why that's the last story in your collection, that you wanted that to be sort of a lasting image, that of illusions being shattered on either side?
Yeah, and also, you know, the collection traces an arc. I mean, the first story is about Vietnamese refugees who come to this country and what happens to them. And the last story, the one we're talking about, is about what happens when these refugees go back to Vietnam. So they made the complete journey now. But it's told from the perspective of the Vietnamese in Vietnam, because oftentimes I think Americans, including Vietnamese Americans, are so ethnocentric that they have a hard time imagining how other people are perceiving them. And I wanted to write this story from that point of view.
And that certainly is one of your major themes in The Sympathizer, the novel that won the Pulitzer Prize, right?
Yeah.
This misconception that...
Misconceptions, dualities, mm-hmm. and what the other thinks of us. And The Sympathizer is, you know, takes those themes and blows them up into this grand scale of spy stories and political thriller and war and all kinds of horrible or great things, depending on your point of view. And The Refugees is very much more about the domestic lives of refugees who are not spectacular for the most part, but they're struggling with these challenges that I think are very human and are very common to refugee experiences.
That's Viet Thanh Nguyen. His new book of short stories is called The Refugees. Coming up, Shani Jardin is here to talk about Twitter's new plans to prevent trolls from harassing people online. That's next on Press Play.
Hey,
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Another week, another pledge from Twitter to tackle its troll problem. Shani Jardin is here to talk about that. She's co-editor of BoingBoing.net and our regular web guru.
Oh, goodness.
I know. I just love saying that
word. High praise.
Let's start with Twitter. And its vice president of engineering, Ed Ho, says that they will implement a fix to combat trolls. So what is it and how's it going to work?
We don't know. Good luck with that. I'm not sure, but I was on Twitter, as I am much of the time right now, and watched that stream of thought be published live. And it was really interesting. It felt like a mea culpa of sorts. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people inside Twitter, in high positions and in kind of grunt work positions, are looking at what their platform enabled, and they're horrified. I mean, I read
and
that yesterday.
And yet they reinstated accounts by white nationalists that they had kicked off before.
Look, these guys, they never expected to be in this position. I can guarantee you that. By the way, there was another story yesterday about how Jack, Twitter CEO, and a number of Twitter employees made huge donations to the ACLU. It's very clear kind of what side of the wokeness spectrum Twitter's people generally fall on. We don't know exactly what they're going to do, but the bottom line of that... maybe it was stream of consciousness, maybe it was prepared. The bottom line of that train of thought is that Twitter is taking this problem seriously. They're acknowledging that they didn't do enough early enough to take ownership of how the architecture of their product enabled some things that are really destructive to happen in our country.
But when it comes to the repeat trolls, they think there's a way to stop them from signing up with a different account.
Well, duh. Yeah. I mean, as somebody who's on the receiving end of horde attacks on the regular from white nationalists, from Nazis, from anti-Semites, when you're on the receiving end of that, it seems stupidly easy for Twitter to use some of the wonderful engineering sense that they use to display ads to you, to display what they think are the most hot Kim Kardashian tweets to you. They've got all different kinds of ways of making their system intelligent, except for when it's, a light beige egg with a Hitler mustache telling you that he wants to rape you and eat your children. Like, somehow, that's just too complicated for us to figure out with the code. Well, figure it out. Because that movement sort of roils online in places like Twitter. Twitter isn't the only place. Another platform they use is Reddit. And the rise of the so-called alt-right that's in the news in Reddit as well this week.
Mm-hmm. So Reddit is banning two subreddits associated with the alt-right.
Reddit / alt-right and alternative right.
Uh-huh.
And there are others, but those are the two big ones where they all congregate.
And so what does that mean? Where will they go?
I'm sure they'll find a place. There was some talk in the press this week about them using a service called Vote, V-O-A-T. It doesn't have very big subscribership numbers, but they're totally okay with things that the Reddit terms of service bans. For instance, doxing people, posting personal information online as a kind of a punishment or bullying or harassment, you know, hate speech, posting pornography, sexually explicit images without the consent of the person in the images, in other words, revenge porn, all kinds of awful stuff that has happened for a long time on Reddit that has gone unchecked in places like Reddit / alt-right and Reddit / alternative right, the now banned subreddits. There are other places where that's okay. Like Reddit was originally a slightly more cleaned up version of 4chan. 4chan was this sort of primordial soup of memes and Nazis and inappropriate sexual content before social media was king. And there will be things that succeed Reddit when Reddit finally gets its act together and takes responsibility for some of the horrible, horrible behavior that they enable online. So, I guess if you're
the lesson is what? That it's impossible to rein these people in? that they'll always find somewhere to express their views? Or is there actually a way for them to be, you know, taken out of the mainstream?
All right. This is my personal view. Each of these companies, Reddit, Twitter, Facebook, all of these platforms where hate is now being disseminated, along with great ideas, when you build a place for that kind of communication and activity and connection to happen, it's your responsibility to stay in tune with how the service is being used and what kind of effect this has on the world. I believe it's the responsibility of the architects, of the designers, of the CEOs, of the VCs who fund these companies, of their shareholders and of their users. But the idea of controlling other people's behavior is a fool's errand. The idea of controlling the rights of others to share their hateful thoughts is silly. But the reason that these this kind of monstrous stuff is just all over the place now. Like, who among us thought that in 2017 it would just be wall-to-wall Nazis all over the news and all over the internet? Who thought that we would be fighting Nazis in the YouTube comments? Like, for real Nazis. Okay? When the world changes, you catch up with it. And I think Silicon Valley is guilty of being drunk on its own success and drunk on all the praise. Well, you know what? If technology is all about creating a better world, get to it. You owe the world an amends for what you've enabled. Mm-hmm. Get to it while you still can.
All right, Jenny Jardin, getting to it for sure. Thank you.
We're still going to stay human and we get to make jokes.
Okay, what could be better? Jenny Jardin, co-editor of boingboing.net and a regular Thursday tech commentator. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
And Julie Myers, also a human, is here.
I am here, though I feel a little bit pressured to make a joke at this point, based on what Shenny just said. And
no
I don't
pressure.
Have one ready.
No pressure. You're off the hook.
Good thing I'm here to share the feedback,
yes,
not jokes
please
today.
Please do.
Okay. So Brian Williams, William Jones on Twitter listened to our interview with a former ambassador from Germany, and he says he just had a dear friend from Germany cancel a trip to visit here. And he says, now I'm going to take my travel money to Berlin to visit. And he wonders how all of this is going to affect the tourism industry, which is incredibly important to Los Angeles.
Oh, interesting point. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. And thank you to everyone who has weighed in. You can still do so whenever you want on Twitter @KCRW Press Play. Thank you, Julie Myers. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you tomorrow.